First of all, my apologies to everybody who suffered whiplash and vertigo in the last. And I'm glad nobody lost their breakfast in the roller coaster. But I think we all share a certain sense of nausea at times when we just feel, or maybe the right word is car sickness. Too many curves, and I know that's tough. But here's the problem, folks. If the status quo prevails, where does it lead? And if you're afraid of change, have you thought much about the continuation of the status quo? I just feel like that is a huge question. And this is where people like ourselves, who are willing to spend a week of our lives to try to imagine, to try to address the struggles of the church, can you see that if we succeed in saving the church as it is, we might end up contributing to the very thing that could be a worse nightmare? I hope that makes sense. If, for example, let's play out a political scenario. Let's say that Al-Qaeda manages to pull off two or three terrorist attacks in the next 18 months on American soil. And how hard is it to imagine the Christian base that now wins elections and controls the presidency, both houses of Congress, and if not already, very close to the Supreme Court. So the religious base that controls our country, is it hard to imagine that base legitimizing dropping nuclear bombs on Iraq and Iran and whoever else causes us trouble? And in that sense, is it hard to imagine our complicity in another war of really unprecedented proportions? And then think of the consequences of that for Muslim-Christian relationships for the next 500 years. Because one characteristic of Western modernity is a short memory. One characteristic of the rest of the world is a long memory. And we think our short memory is a virtue, but it's only a virtue if you think that forgetting your past atrocities is a virtue, along with maybe forgetting offenses against you. But at any rate, a lot is at stake. And so to me, I'm not trying to motivate you by fear, but I guess I'm just trying to say, if fear is there for us, let's at least be equal opportunity people for fear. And think of the fear of the status quo. Because I think we're not surrounded with safe options and dangerous options. I think we have all dangerous options. But in some ways, that's what faith, it seems to me, is about. It's about walking into the dangerous options. A question that I can't remember who asked it, but the question was, where is there space and time for these conversations? And that, of all the questions that came out to me, was one of the most important. Because there are places where it is unsafe to have these conversations. And then in the busyness and challenges of daily life, there isn't time. So we need safe space and we need sufficient time. I have never been divorced, but friends of mine who've been divorced, when they go back and assess some of the pain of the divorce, and then they think about what kept them busy when their marriage was salvageable, one of the huge regrets is, why was I so worried about making a few extra dollars? This divorce cost me more money than I ever made up till this point in my life. And why was I so concerned about my status at work? The chance to live under the same roof with my children is worth more to me than any job. And they just start assessing the expenditure of time. and the sense that, gosh, the right amount of time and energy expended on the right things could have made such a huge difference, but we were driven. And then, you know, and then something happens. So that is, to me, a really, really interesting question. That so many of these questions have to do with how much change can we handle? I mean, and how much can stay the same, and that kind of a thing. Let me just pick one. For example, is looking for anchors part of the problem? What is the role of Satan and evil in this quest? This is a great example. If we had big arguments about the nature of Satan and never talked about the nature of empire, we could all agree on a literal Satan and then end up being tools of another one. It's not to say those aren't important issues, but it's just interesting. A friend of mine, one of my mentors, says, what you focus on determines what you miss. So to keep asking ourselves with some space and time, what is it by focusing on this argument that we're missing? And I felt like that question was sort of underlying so many of these. In a world of flux, in a liquid state, what do you hold on to? Thinking of pendulum swings and a center, you know, it's the idea that the ultimate desire is to just hang in the middle and not have to be moving, maybe. Well, that makes us focus on certain things. In fact, by the way, that viewpoint always strengthens the powers that be in the status quo if the idea is don't rock the boat and get to stasis. So many of the pain that I feel in these questions and the dynamic of these questions, to me, they're exactly the right things for us to be asking. The one question that I... Let me see if I can find it here. But someone said, like, what does this mean for us as pastors? And what is ministry about if it's not about preserving some of these ideas? That to me is a really exciting question, because in fact that's what we're going to talk about this afternoon. What is the church for if it's not for maintaining an ideology or a set of beliefs? I want to maintain without any wavering at all my commitment to Jesus Christ as Lord. I feel very much like the apostles on that day when Jesus fed the crowd, and then the crowd wanted more bread, and he said some provocative things which sounded immoral and grotesque. They sounded like cannibalism. You have to eat my flesh. I mean, you can imagine Jesus' PR department saying, that was a big mistake. That cannibalism language, what are you trying to do here? You know, your ratings went down 17% from that one speech, and you're, you know, anyway. But he, you know, the disciples say, look, where else are we going to go? Who else has the words of eternal life? And my questioning process has led me to a place where I am more confident in Jesus as the hope of the world than I've ever been. Although I'm less confident that the gospel is primarily a message about how to solve the problem of original sin, so your passport will be clean, so you'll be let through the border. Kind of a visa problem theology. I'm less confident of that. I don't know if we want to have any questions, direct questions, but I would kind of like to be able to do that. So if someone wanted to ask a direct question, there's my reaction to these questions. But does someone want to follow up with one? Yes.
The question that came to mind after the session this morning is, if the church has been so wrong for so long about so many things, and if we're going to be also very wrong about very many things, what does that say about God?
That's a good question. By the way, you know, this is I hear this a lot. Like the really nasty reviews of my new book are like, McLaren is so arrogant, he finally thinks he has it right. I just want to ask those people, what denomination are you? Oh, we're Lutheran. Well, you follow a guy who thought he got it right, and he was a lot nastier to the people he thought were wrong than I am.
You're a nice guy.
Yeah, you know.
Luther wasn't.
I agree with.
Yeah. So what your question does then is it lets us say all of us think the church has been desperately wrong about a lot of things for a long time, and we think its worst mistakes could be in the future. So,
God would allow that.
What kind of God would allow that? Yeah, it's obviously a God who actually is not a respecter of persons, and who doesn't feel obligated to save either the Jewish people or the Christian people from being stupid. And he's obviously not a controlling God. He does everything he can to help them, but they still make mistakes. And that, you know, if we take that seriously, what would that do to us spiritually? I think it would, I mean, that would have a profound effect. So that question to me is very powerful. What kind of God would that be?
You could also ask, what kind of question is that?
What would you say about the question?
Why are you asking it? What's underneath it? Say some more about it.
Yeah, say some more about the question. Let me help you. Let me help you by asking you a question. I'm not going to let you off the hook. But what kind of God, what's the fear that feels about God? I guess I can say it that way. What's the anxiety that would give you about God? Could you try to put that into words, Mark?
That's really hard. Because it applies to you with what you just said, that God is perhaps no respecter of persons, including us, that he lets us make mistakes that are very costly, not just for us, but for a great number of people, and a great many places for a great number of generations. It says a lot about our own responsibility. And I have trouble putting my finger on exactly what that anxiety is, because I personally find in the things that you have written and others moving in the same direction, I found a wonderful freedom and even a deep joy. But I'm not sure I would have an answer to this question.
Yeah.
Beyond what you just said, and yet the question still troubles me, and that's where I am.
You want to comment on that, Al?
Yeah, without answering your question directly, I'll never forget sitting down with my mother-in-law, who's now in her 80s, and she looks back over her life, and she says, I mean, like, she's got wonderful kids. I'm married to one of them, and my kids are wonderful because of her, and she just says, I just made a mess of the whole thing. And sometimes in your question, one feels that about the church. However, I have to say, she is my mother, and I wouldn't be standing here saying Jesus is my Lord without my mother. So it ain't all black. You know?
And I recognize that though my tradition is different in many respects from other traditions, we all have this desire to identify ourselves, to identify God, to define Him, so that we can feel secure.
Yeah.
And what happened to me reading New Kind of Christian, reading Generous Orthodoxy, having conversations with a Buddhist, having conversations with folks in other denominations, is I began to stop and think, if God is allowing all these mess-ups to occur, maybe they aren't as significant from an eternal perspective as I think they are. And what's happened to me now, on the plane coming over here, I'm sitting next to a guy who starts up a conversation with me about the fact that he's on a business trip, he's left for a week, and 3 days earlier his 16-year-old daughter ran away from home. And how did he get on a plane and leave mom at home to deal with now her sixth time to run away and she's been gone the longest? What are they going to do? And I thought, you know, because we think the only possible good thing is for her to return home and behave herself. But in reality, the very great thing that may happen is she may be transformed by this, what looks like a very tragic experience. And 20 years from now, she looks back and talks about the whole restoration process of her family and all these great things. We get so focused on it has to be fit a particular pattern. And God has to fit a particular pattern. And He is totally apathetic about our desire to define everything.
Yeah. We'll have some more time for discussion later. I really should tell a joke in closing, which is terrible to do after the story. But the story, in many ways, is the awareness that tragedy, short-term tragedy, can become the inciting incident for other happy endings. You know, and I think this is part of what keeps literature going, and what hope is about, and the biblical narrative is about, and what resurrection is about, and all the rest. But I just should tell this as we break for lunch. And some of you have heard this. You know, this sounds like a joke, but of course this has happened about a fundamentalist, a mystic, and an evangelical who were in a car crash together, and they died and showed up on the at the gates of heaven. And an angel came out and said, "Look, before we let you in, you know, you're obviously all great people, but we do have to go through a kind of an interview process to make sure everything's okay." And the angel said, "So who would like to go first?" The interview actually is with Jesus. So the mystic said, "I'd like to go first." And he went in, and you know, they go into this little office, and a hand comes out and turns over the sign, you know, appointment in progress, please do not disturb. And about an hour passes, and the door opens, and the mystic walks out, and he says, "I knew I was wrong, and I was. I knew I was wrong, and I was." And he goes into heaven. He's sort of smiling as he says this. Well, then the evangelical goes in next, and hand turns the sign, and he's in there for about 5 hours, as time is measured in heaven. And and finally the door opens, and the evangelical comes out, and he goes, "I knew I was right, but I was wrong. I knew I was right. How could I be so wrong?" And he was escorted into heaven. The fundamentalist then went in, sign turned, and actually about 3 weeks passed with the door not opening. And finally, you know what happened. The door opened, and Jesus walked out and said, "I thought I was right. How could I have been so wrong?"